then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's December the 11th, 2014. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, this week I think I'm going to put the heavy stuff right up front. I'm going to try to conduct a serious conversation, as the liberals say, with a very important group of people in our society. I refer to police officers, the real cops on the street, not the bureaucrats and the sergeant and above category who are basically political animals and who never stir outside the station house or the precinct. Now, am I talking to FBI agents? No, probably not. In the first place, they're not actual law enforcement officers and haven't been since J. Edgar Hoover died and the Bureau became politicized to a degree that Hoover would never have tolerated for 10 seconds. I'm talking today to actual, for real, street cops and detectives and corrections officers who have been forced into the morally tenuous position of being what FBI agents always signed up for from the get-go. Yeah, I know that sounds obscure. Never mind. I'll get into that in a little while, but let me digress a bit first. Now, over the past several weeks, we've seen what's going on in the streets of St. Louis and now in New York and Cleveland and other cities as mobs of niggers are doing their standard Negroid thing, marching and yelling and hollering and waving signs and burning buildings and attacking white passersby and, above all, looting. I think it's clear that for the vast majority of the so-called protesters, it's not about the gentle giant or the dead cigarette nigga who learned in the end that, yes, those things really will kill you. No, it's not about anything like that. Now, what these occasions represent to the overwhelming majority of our darker brethren is an opportunity to break into stores and take what the white man has got, or actually in many cases what the Jew or the Asian has got, or what they perceive as the ultimate fruits of white civilization. Anyway, they get to take these things without paying for them every time there's one of these big hanahanas about some nigger getting shot in the street. Now, things like running shoes and flat-screen TVs and cell phones, clothes, flashy jewelry, boxes of Swisher sweets that they can make joints from, 40-ounce bottles of malt liquor, boxes of Banquet frozen fried chicken, and, of course, their beloved grape drink. Now, in other words, these alleged social and civil rights protests, even more so than in the past, are an opportunity for niggers to take for free what they genuinely believe they should be receiving for free. What their so-called leaders in the civil rights industry have led them to believe all their lives that they deserve to get for free. Now, you have to understand that for most black folks, their idea of so-called reparations for slavery isn't some big huge check from Uncle Sam in their mailbox to compensate for the fact that 150 years ago, their great-great-great-grandparents might or might not have had a bullwhip taken to them. No, the black man has known for generations what the white man allegedly owes him, what his reparations are to be. They seriously expect us to allow them to lie around all their lives and have the white man support them in the style to which they would like to become accustomed, without ever having to do a lick of work or earn it in any way. Now, people sometimes ask what the black man wants. Well, he wants two things. The first thing he wants is to live in some kind of American Garden of Eden, which I suppose would be one big hood or housing project with a monster shopping mall or two, where he gets everything he wants for free. Which is the dream of a child, and that's not surprising since as a race they're very childlike. It's kind of like that old song, The Big Rock Candy Mountain. Among white people, that's a children's song. Among blacks, it's a political platform. Nor does this dream seem in any way unreasonable or impossible to the black man, because for almost 60 years now, the evil Jewish and liberal bastards of the Democratic Party have done their best to give the black man just that, beginning with the so-called War on Poverty in 1965. So I can see why the poor nappy-headed eejits believe this particular dream might be capable of achievement. They've gotten kind of a taste for it over several generations now, and they probably, honest to God, don't understand why the gravy train can't last forever, and why sooner or later they're going to have to face childhood's end. Now, the second thing the black man wants is something he can never have. He wants to be white, and he never can be. And that is the true source of his bottomless rage. And that is why black rage can never be satisfied by anything we ever do for them. Because we cannot give them our beautiful skin and our beautiful hair and eyes. We cannot give them our mighty art and literature, which they cannot understand, but which they can sense is great. We cannot give them our wonderful music, which they can hear for themselves is beautiful, but which they can never create. We can't give them our intelligence and our creativity and our accumulated knowledge and the heritage which has shaped the world that they live in, including the very language they speak, more or less. That wonderful world which they can never be part of. And if you don't believe any of this is true, I give you the example of Michael Jackson. You give a nigger $100 million, and what does he do with it? He uses a large part of that money to try and turn himself white. Of course, all Jackson basically accomplished was to have himself medically transformed into a Puerto Rican with a fake nose that used to start melting and falling off, but we won't get into that. Now, you want to know what the hottest-selling beauty aid in the world market is today? Check the internet. Skin lightening creams that break down the melanin in black females' skins. A much cheaper and faster 21st century version of the Michael Jackson treatment of the 1980s. Middle-class and quote-unquote educated black women are desperately bleaching themselves all over to try to attract white men as mates, because male niggers are such primitive beasts and losers that even their own women can't stand them. Back as far as the 1980s, one day I was sitting in the break room in a major corporation on one of my many temp agency jobs, and I overheard some of our Shivas talking about how they could lure or entice white men into dating them and marrying them. I normally made it a point to keep quiet about race at work for obvious reasons, but I couldn't resist asking one of these women later on why they wanted to marry white men, and she told me, "We don't want our babies to be looking like no monkeys. We want our babies to be light and bright." Just as I knew white soldiers who served in Clinton's occupation army in Haiti in the 1990s, who came back telling of black Haitian women who constantly tried to seduce them so that they could become pregnant with mulatto infants who might someday become part of the Haitian ruling class. Now, the point I'm trying to make here is that in the final analysis, America's race problem is insoluble, because the morality of it all aside, we simply cannot give them what they want. Our white bodies and genetic abilities and our angelic appearance that makes us look human, while their own resemblance to the great apes is so strong that even they are aware of it. All we can do for them is to essentially commit racial suicide by offering up our last remaining gene pool to try and give their nigger genotype an upgrade. Kind of like mixing ice cream with dog dew in order to slightly improve the taste of the dog dew, so to speak. The problem can't be solved. It can only be contained and postponed. And to get back to my original topic, this is where cops and soldiers come in. And I'm sure there's some of you listening, if only in a professional capacity. You are the ones who are containing and postponing the inevitable unraveling of this terrible problem which history and liberal malice has handed us. And maybe you shouldn't be. I am seriously suggesting to you that maybe you guys need to stand aside and let the plane crash. Then do what you can to put out the fires and care for the white survivors. Cops and the United States military are absolutely central to the American dilemma of the 21st century, because it is their guns and their willingness to use those guns against other people that keeps the present dictatorship in power. No dictatorship can survive without an army of gun-toting goons who are willing to shoot, maim, torture, and imprison whatever other human beings their masters point them at. And that's you guys. All you cops and military personnel who are listening. I'm sorry, but it's true. Things have changed. Whatever you thought things were like back when you came in, you are now the villains in the black hats. You are the bad guys now, and you need to come to grips with that fact. Now, I do not use the term dictatorship lightly. It is simply a description of fact. As of November the 20th, 2014, the day that an American president abolished the southern border by decree and welcomed into our homeland 34 million foreigners who have no right to be here and who are breaking the law by their presence in exchange for their future votes to keep the Democratic Party in perpetual power, the day he did that without even the pretense of consultation with the people's elected representatives, in direct violation of the law, and nothing was done about it, largely because Americans are so afraid of you and those guns on your hips. Now, as of that day, November the 20th, 2014, the United States of America is over. And I'm sorry, all of you white police officers and soldiers, but you can't just ignore it. You cannot pretend that nothing has happened. You took your oath to serve one country, however flawed it may have been at the time. But no kidding, guys, that country no longer exists. Barack Obama erased it with the stroke of his executive pen. Now the America that you thought existed, the America you thought you were serving, has been pulled out from under you like a rug. And at some point in time, in some way or another, you're going to have to acknowledge that, if only to yourselves. You're going to have to acknowledge that the country you took an oath to serve isn't there anymore, and that your oath of allegiance is no longer valid. Now, all you cops and soldiers and servicemen out there, I want you to look at what's happening in Ferguson, Missouri, and New York, and Cleveland, and Phoenix, and now in Florida, as time and again, law enforcement officers are compelled to take physical action against men and sometimes women with dark skins, or else stand there and let some 6'4" gorilla beat on you and maybe take your weapon and kill you with it. In doing so, white officers place not only their careers but their lives on the line, since I think we all have a good idea of what happens to cops in prison. So far, the ancient grand jury system seems to be holding and acting as a shield for white officers whom the left-lib Democrat and nigger mobs are trying to lynch for daring to defend themselves against violent, lawless man-things with dark skin. But we don't know how long it will hold. Ironically, this is actually the very purpose for which grand juries were first established in the Magna Carta back in 1215, to review evidence and to make sure that there is a case to answer before someone is arrested and dragged away in chains and imprisoned and subjected to torment and jeopardy from the law. The grand jury was meant as a restraint on government power and abuse, although for many years it hasn't served as such. But in these two cases, this ancient legal institution returned to its roots, so to speak, and held off the liberal nigger Democrat lynch mob. Damn, that was clumsy. As an aside, we really, really need to figure out some way to designate the racial enemy in a single short, snappy word or two. Kind of like we call non-racially aware white people muggles. Anyway, let me get back to what I was talking about. The fact is, oh, badge-carrying pale white boys, that the government of that country that you thought you were serving will destroy you if it finds you inconvenient. Our kind don't run it anymore. It is run by niggers and dykes and faggots and foreigners who shouldn't even be here, and above all, it is run by the accursed liberal Democrat scum who consider you to be peasants and less than human. You think that now the grand juries in Missouri and New York have rendered their verdict that that's the end of it for Darren Wilson and Daniel Pantaleo? Dream on, little pale white boys with badges, dream on. The big nig at the Justice Department, you know, Eric Holder, the mulatto who supposedly resigned several months ago to take the heat off the Fast and Furious investigation, but who for some reason just keeps hanging around and coming into work every day, that Eric Holder. He has turned his dogs, or perhaps I should say his baboons, loose on Officer Wilson and Officer Pantaleo. It will take some time, but they're dead meat, just like Clive and Bundy and his family are dead meat. We can't have pale little white boys defying and embarrassing the one, now can we? You remember what happened to the cops in the Rodney King Simi Valley case, right? They were cleared by the California courts and by their own internal affairs divisions, and then they were charged with so-called civil rights violations. The jury verdict was ignored, and the constitutional prohibition against double jeopardy was ignored, and the cops went to prison anyway, in order to bribe the niggers into not rioting anymore. The niggers and the liberals used black violence to get what they want, not for the first time. It worked then, and it will work in Ferguson and New York and Cleveland today. Now, if you are out on that street and you are forced to defend yourself against a violent criminal with a dark skin, the same people who sign your paycheck are going to throw you under the bus for real. Think, guys, think. Stop pretending that what you see happening around you isn't happening. I can't advise you what to do. No, I mean, I really can't advise you what to do, because that probably would be illegal and give the faux cops of the FBI who are listening to this an excuse to come and scoop me up. But if you are a law enforcement officer, and by that I mean a real one and not a bureaucrat, if you are serving in the United States military, then in the name of all that is holy, do two things. First off, open your eyes and admit to yourself that you are seeing what you are seeing. And the second thing I want you to do is think. Now, this is a group I don't think anybody ever figured they'd hear on Radio Free Northwest, including me. But I think it's appropriate to dedicate our first music break to officers Darren Wilson and Daniel Pantaleo. I think this has a message for our racial brothers with the badges. This is Alice Cooper. Okay, this is going to be our weekly Edgar Steele segment. Now, this time I'm not going to include the usual long introduction, because I know that after a while you guys do get bored with hearing me say the same things over and over again. That's the thing, though. The only way that we can counter the dictatorship's narrative about Ed is to use a lot of spaced repetition so that the truth can somehow pound its way out of this diving bell in which it has been sunk to the bottom of a sea of lies, so to speak. Anyway, comrades, I give you the late Edgar J. Steele.
My name is Edgar J. Steele. It's June 10, 2009, and this is a nickel rant entitled, Why He Did It, and Why Von Braun Won't Be the Last. Suddenly, the news today is full of yet another crazed gunman opens fire story. James Von Brunn, inveterate internet crank and author of Kill the Best Gentiles, was shot by Washington, D.C. National Holocaust Museum armed guards as he tried to force his way in with a rifle. Von Brunn shot and injured one of the guards before he himself was critically injured by another just inside the entrance. At the time of this broadcast and writing, both Von Brunn and the injured guard are hospitalized and in grave condition. The TV news today is full of the question, always asked after one of these shootings, but never of those of us capable of providing the correct answer. Why did he do it? Always, the news anchors and pundits go on to answer their own question by dismissing the gunmen of the moment as a right-wing, hate-filled nutcase, illustrative of why further restrictions on liberty and gun ownership are necessary. Already, the Southern Poverty Law Center has weighed in on the national news. You won't be hearing anything but their side of things in that forum, though. Taken at face value, Von Brunn's explanation would be as inflammatory as his actions if even that were to be trotted out. It won't, though. And certainly, the real reason for Von Brunn's outburst today never will be broadcast beyond the confines of these outer fringes of the internet. Below, in today's broadcast, I'm going to give the honest answer as to why Von Brunn went off on his abortive shooting rampage. Probably better than he could himself. No, certainly better than he could himself. I never met Von Brunn, but I did brush up against him in a series of acerbic exchanges a few years ago. Confusing me with one of his peers in the white supremacist movement, I get that a lot, by the way, it seems that he didn't approve of my advocacy of nonviolence. I had written the following in a 2006 investment advice piece, quote, "Remember to have priorities. A safe and productive place for your family to tough out the coming hard times is first. Food stores, independent water and sewage, a way to defend what you have. Always have 6 months' living expenses, including debt service, in cash, even though the dollar is falling like a rock. These things are more important than any other sort of investment." Close quote. Von Brunn's response to the world at large to my commentary was, quote, "Edgar Steele's advice to investors fails to comprehend the extent of a money meltdown disaster. Recollect, Russian Revolution, Illuminati, Bolshevik, torture, rape, and butchery, the deliberate starvation of kulaks, the incineration of 20th century Europe, Mao, Pol Pot, the world flowed with blood, stunk with unburied corpses. The Illuminati is ubiquitous and not compassionate. Today, we are witnessing the penultimate stage in Illuminati Zionist globalization of planet Earth. Protesters will be eliminated. There is no escape, no place to hide. To protect what you have and take what you need, the most important investment Aryans can make today is not, as Steele advises, now. For a limited time, the most important investment is in ammo. At last, you wimps must stand and fight." Close quote. An old man, 89 according to news reports. Today, Von Brunn apparently got tired of waiting for his own personal, quote, penultimate stage, close quote. Today, he set out to practice what he preached. Doubtless, Von Brunn did not expect to get felled so quickly, but he surely knew that his was a one-way mission, nevertheless. Von Brunn was making a statement and setting an example. Both provide a lesson to which we as a nation should attend, but which we undoubtedly will ignore yet again. Make no mistake, I do not defend Von Brunn's rhetoric or actions. On the contrary, I roundly condemn them both. Even so, listen up, folks, because there will be more, lots more, acts like today before this is over. I am an attorney best known for defending the politically incorrect in cases where our important constitutional rights are at issue in situations where those people are being railroaded for their beliefs in the context of trumped-up civil and/or criminal charges. I have defended and provided legal advice to probably more of the politically incorrect than has any other attorney in America today. Always, I have required that they be fundamentally decent people, trapped on the business end of a railroad job, and innocent. Always, they must be innocent, regardless of how things might eventually turn out in court. And believe me, I get at least one opportunity each and every week to defend the politically incorrect. Problem is, usually they're guilty, or stupid, or more likely both. I'll tell you this much about Von Braun, though. Stupid, he is not. Reportedly, he's a member of Mensa, the group for bona fide geniuses. I believe it. Would I defend Von Braun for his actions today? Absolutely not. Unless it was simply to secure him a fair plea deal or at a sentencing hearing. Never could I defend his conduct at trial. And even then, I wouldn't do a single thing for him pro bono. Fair disclosure. If anything, I am biased against James Von Braun, not for him or his cause. Though you may end up wondering about that after you hear me out today and learn why I think he did what he did and why this is just the beginning. Sooner or later, somebody had better pay attention because guys like Von Braun aren't going away anytime soon. So, why did he do it? Well, the easy answer is his age. Von Braun dedicated his life in recent years to what he saw as an inevitable armed confrontation between the government and a supposed army of others believing as did he. Time was running out, and the revolution hadn't yet begun. It is easy to believe that he opted for making a statement while he still could, perhaps hoping to spark the beginning of the revolution he believed to be inevitable. Frankly, that's the most likely reason for why James Von Braun took a rifle to a site that he found more offensive than most any other in America today. But there are lots of oldsters who don't take to the streets with a rifle in hand. Von Braun's reasons go much deeper, obviously, and are shared by a great many others in America today. Knowing why and doing something about it now might prevent senseless bloodshed in the future. In a very real sense, today's shooting is of a piece with that of the abortion doctor a week ago. That shooter was surprised to find himself treated as a common criminal, which he is, of course. Similarly, Von Braun, no doubt, also considers himself to be a martyr, deserving of admiration, and a figure likely to be vindicated in the longer view of history. Make no mistake about this, though. Von Braun, too, is a criminal, albeit an uncommon one. I'd like to say, when speaking of those responsible for the horrible financial catastrophe now crashing down around all of us, it takes a towering intellect to create a towering house of cards. The same can be said for James Von Braun's intellectual world. A less serious way of describing it would be to call him a victim of his own desperation. He trapped himself with his own rhetoric and felt compelled to act upon it. A decorated veteran of World War II and a PT boat captain, Von Braun was no shrinking violet. Mere rhetoric is insufficient for the true man of action, you know. In fact, 25 years ago, Von Braun was arrested and received a lengthy prison sentence for then attempting to place the members of the Federal Reserve Bank under citizen's arrest. At gunpoint, it must be added, a worthy if misguided adventure. Like many others, James Von Braun feels victimized by Jewish control of America and offended by the preferential treatment accorded minorities, particularly black. His anger is born of the frustration of being unfairly treated in the country for which he so proudly fought. All over TV today, clueless anchors and pundits dismiss Von Braun as just another irrational white supremacist, racist, anti-Semite. Perhaps. But then, that ignores the question of why he might be all those things and whether, just maybe, he and others might have some justified complaints that are not being addressed. In fact, The short shrift being given to von Braun's position today helps to hasten the day when the next guy, just like him, does something just as off the wall. America, we need to talk about racism against white. It is not racist to demand equal treatment for white America. Equal rights for all, special rights for none. We need to talk about unfair treatment of whites by an increasingly remote and controlled American government. We need to talk about the looting of the American taxpayer by an indisputably secretive and private organization, the Federal Reserve Bank, which is owned in its entirety by Jewish interests. Facts are facts, like them or not. We need to talk about the circumspection of the constitutional rights guaranteed to all of us. We need to talk about the illegal and unjust wars of conquest being maintained overseas by America, primarily for the benefit of Israel. We need to talk about the growing unemployment and the jobs sent overseas by the captains of industry who increasingly see themselves as mere citizens of the world and not of America. Why did von Braun choose to unload at the National Holocaust Museum? Because it is an edifice to one of the most stupendous lies of modern times, paid for and maintained with taxpayer dollars. That's why. Did the Holocaust take place? Well, that depends upon what you mean by Holocaust. But clearly, 6 million Jews were not systematically gassed and cremated by the Germans during World War II. I have written extensively on this, both in my book, Defense of Racism, and in essays such as Holy Holocaust. People go to jail in other countries for saying just what I have said. They're trying to make it just as illegal to say these things in America today. Why? Why must it be illegal to challenge the accuracy of an allegedly historical event? This patent unfairness is just a part of that which von Braun symbolically struck out at today. People like James von Braun deserve to be listened to. They deserve to be heard. After all, are they not citizens? Do they not deserve the manifest protections accorded to the politically correct? Not so you could tell it. Not if you believe what you hear in the media today, that's for sure. Von Braun is not purely a nutcase, and he is no isolated incident. Just a fair shake, a fair day in court, that's all they ask. To be heard out, to be given a seat at the table. But no, that increasingly is denied to the James von Brauns of today, as made abundantly clear by the imminent appointment of a Latina racist to the U.S. Supreme Court. Make no mistake, today's was no isolated incident. You will see more and more shootouts like what took place in Washington, D.C. this morning, until America begins to listen to all her citizens and accords all of her children an equal voice in her affairs. Mark my words well, America. New America, an idea whose time has come. My name is Edgar J. Steele, and thanks for listening. Please visit my website, www.nickelrant.com, for other messages just like this one.
Good evening, comrades. I'm going to talk about Thoughts on Hitler and Other Essays, and these are by Erman Vinson. Vinson points out that he is a thought criminal who does not wish to be known. Now, he's on something of a quest to determine if white nationalism is a worldview of reason, morality, and good taste, and he determines that it is. And in addition to that, it's the only legitimate heir and only possible continuation of Western civilization. Now, he points out that you don't have to defend every idea of National Socialism to say that whites have common interests. But one of the first questions that he's going to ask is, what are we going to do about Hitler? Should we expunge or abandon him? even if we did, would that help? The author comes to the conclusion that it would not help us because even conservative Christians such as Pat Buchanan are taunted at times, or were back when he was more prominent in politics, about this supposed connection even when none exists. So what are we to understand about National Socialism? Well, the author points out that it's not so much a dictatorship as it is a worldview, and it's a racial worldview. Now, within this worldview, you could still have voting, for example, because National Socialism isn't just a party, it's actually a system. In some cases, white ethnicities could still be a melting pot if one wished. My note on this is that once you understand Adolf Hitler as an avatar who came as a man, you won't worry so much over trivial things like temporal nations, although you still might revere Austria and Germany. So that's just my note, but that's from my bias. Now, the author talks about ancient European history. He's interested in the pre-Indo-Europeans and also the Indo-Europeans because he wants to know, what should we call ourselves? Should we use the term Aryan? Should we use the term white? And the author acknowledges there are limitations of both. The term Aryan, for example, might not apply to someone who is Finnish, but certainly they're white, and the term white might be a more difficult term if you're going to talk about a southern Italian who could be dark. So there's that issue, and the author says that we can use these terms as well as we understand that there are limitations. The author talks about how the narrative of World War II has changed and how initially back in the 50s it was this notion of America fighting a dictatorship. But over time, Americans and Europeans came to be classified as racist, and the Holocaust was used to guilt all whites. All whites are potential National Socialists, and in my notes I say would that it were, because whites either can face oblivion or they can get to know an Austrian painter with a race-saving gospel. So at this point, what I'm writing in my notes is, could we please have less about the Holocaust and more about him, more about Adolf Hitler? Because this book kind of goes on and on, has multiple articles about Holocaust guilt. Now, the author makes the point that this new spirit of acceptance within Europe that sort of embraces Judaism also tends to embrace other groups, and that paved the way for the Muslims. Now, the author reminds us that Islam is not moderate because the Quran has something called abrogating verses. So a verse that is moderate is not necessarily followed, in fact, rarely, if ever. The author also speaks briefly of Steele, of Edgar J. Steele's book, Defense of Racism, and is concerned about the term racism because it's a term invented by the left. And once you use it, you've lost ground already. So that may be more of a superficial criticism to whatever Steele was saying in his book. Maybe that's a book I'll review eventually. And then there's also an essay about Amy Beale, and she was a PhD student, and I'm sure you've heard of her. She could not grasp that South Africa had a strong economy and an infrastructure because it was white dominated, and decided to go down to South Africa and help blacks. She was attacked and was killed. That's, of course, a very sad story, needless to say. The author also mentions Jane Elliott and her exercises or demonstrations that she does, mostly tending to ridicule blue-eyed people in her seminars, and basically says that whites, or does an exercise in which she says whites are no good. Although this is supposed to be a demonstration, if you've ever watched one of her seminars on YouTube, they're really quite vicious. Because this was written in the early 2000s, there's talk about Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ and that controversy, which is more important for those people that are Bible-based conservatives. Now, at the end, my criticism of this book, as I've said before, is that the title and the cover art, although they certainly say you shouldn't judge a book by its cover, and that's certainly true, the book makes a promise that those reading it might get to know him better. They might get to know Adolf Hitler better. But what I'm coming away with is really a series of essays that is more like The Culture of Critique light. And that's fine if you don't have time to read The Culture of Critique and you want a kind of a gist of that book. Now, the other criticism I have is that it does make some reference to the U.S. and the Allies winning the Second World War. Of course, no white nation really won the Second World War, because clearly, if you look around the world today, that's clearly not what happened. So, on that rather grim note, I would say these are insightful essays. They have some value. It's just that, personally, if I were advising the author, I would have changed the title and possibly the cover, because it really gives an impression of something that you don't get in this book. So, have a good evening. Thank you for listening, and hail victory, comrades.
This is Mike Cross.
Greetings from Seattle, comrades. I'm Andy Donner. Earlier this year, Radio Free Northwest ran segments involving conspiracy theory, which drew quite a few complaints from the audience. Today, I'm here to defend the field of conspiracy theory, and specifically to stick up for Lord Lucan, who submitted these segments. While I myself have little interest in conspiracy theory, I have a high level of distaste for those of you on Lord Lucan's case about his subject matter and remarks. Since 2014 is almost over, and it's the year where I insult the audience, I've got to make sure I get my digs in now. As I said, I have no tangible interest in conspiracy theory, but I'm not remotely opposed to it and haven't been for some time. And more importantly, none of you should be opposed to it either. I know quite a few of you out there tend to think of it as a low-class or generally ignorant type of activity, and that's somewhat accurate in a lot of cases. After all, quite a few of the more well-known conspiracy theories sound something like Dick Cheney channeled the ghost of Adolf Hitler to help him invade Switzerland so he could control the world supply of chocolate because reasons. And I'm sure it hasn't escaped your notice, quite a few of those pushing various conspiracy theories tend to lack basic social skills and are even downright schizophrenic. But let's back up for a second so I can remind you of one very important fact. You, yourself, right now are listening to Radio Free Northwest. Just about every single one of you shares our politics, but only some of you realize white nationalists come across in exactly the same way as conspiracy theorists. I happened to bring this subject up to Harold and a couple of other local comrades while preparing this talk, and Harold reminded me of something very important. In the past, when someone has approached him with interest in National Socialism, white nationalism, racialism, etc., he made a very particular point. To quote him, "You want involved? Fine. But understand everything you've ever been told is a lie." While there's certainly an element of hyperbole in there somewhere, you all know what he means, and I can't imagine any of you disagree. One of the folks to whom we recently sent an introduction packet contacted us through the party message board. One of the remarks he offered was his level of shock at how much he had been lied to about various parts of history. I remember the exact moment in time I learned the Holocaust was a lie. The level of rage I experienced during that instant has yet to be matched by other stimuli I've come across since. I'm certain just about every single one of us can recall a similar incident in our pasts, but it's important to comprehend said incident is nothing short of accepting a conspiracy theory as flat fact. And with that, it would be wise to examine exactly what constitutes a conspiracy theory. The theory part is pretty obvious, but conspiracy could use a definition. The most functional way of describing a conspiracy is a group of people deliberately concealing malicious activity. This leads us to the most common objection to conspiracy theory as a field. There's this idea out there that conspiracy theories are always wrong because it's impossible for anyone to keep a secret. Well, a conspiracy theorist would actually agree. If people could keep secrets, there wouldn't be anything to base conspiracy theories on. And beyond that, there's also the notion people don't do bad things in groups. But every one of you knows better. I shouldn't have to remind anyone of the Jew. That particular race does more bad things as a collective than any other manifestation of evil throughout history, and most of them aren't even conscious of it. Alright, I have to admit the partial lack of deliberate intention somewhat invalidates an association with conspiracy theory, but not enough to entirely wreck my case. A white nationalist ought to understand perfectly well how race affects group tendencies. But let's consider those facts from a non-nationalist perspective. White nationalists appear, to the uninitiated, to accuse other races, the Jew in particular, of a conspiracy against whites. And that's a good bit of what we actually do. Most of us can clearly recall a time when we would have dismissed anything having to do with racial reality as nothing short of redneck, ignoramus, low-class conspiracy theory, right along with all the other crap out there. With that understood, is it really a good idea to dismiss conspiracy theory off the cuff? I thought about going over a few examples of historic and political oddities, such as what makes Aryans and Jews unique and special, but I would inevitably cause a certain portion of the listening audience to lose the plot. Nevertheless, remember the remark Harold made. Everything you've been told is a lie. One of the local comrades and I periodically discuss what you might call out-of-place artifacts. Just like with race, there's an official version of science, history, religion, and lots of other subjects which doesn't quite stack up against observation. Someone who has taken the red pill on race very quickly runs into all this other stuff by virtue of the fact that they're paying attention. I don't care to get into details, since if I did, I'd have the entire audience mad at me for one reason or another, just like Lord Lucan has drawn a bit of fire for discussing one or two of the non-mainstream explanations for the state of the world. If interested, you're all perfectly free to explore for yourself. I do, however, need to get today's final jab at the audience in. I'm perplexed why there's so much rage directed at Lord Lucan for talking about these matters in the white nationalist public when it doesn't appear most of you actually care whether or not white nationalism saves the white race. I normally sign off with a hearty "Hail Victory, comrades," but it doesn't seem appropriate after my last observation. Enjoy the rest of your week.
Westbound and down, 18-wheels are rolling. Are we gonna do what they say can't be done? We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. I'm westbound just like a bandit run. Keep your foot hard on the pedal, son, never mind them brakes. Let it all hang out, cause we got to run to make.
Greetings, comrades. This is the trucker coming at you from a new little rolling house. I just moved into a 2015 brand new Freightliner Cascadia. The company moved me out of my old 2010 that had 984,000 miles on it and into this new truck that now has 570 miles on it. Just started driving it yesterday, and yeah, no, that's not much, but it'll be up there here shortly. And I hope the audio quality is okay, because I figure I'd give it a whirl, as this truck doesn't have all the rattles and stuff of a five-year-old truck. But anyway, for those of you who are doing your research on the homeland and stuff, I just was trying out a new program or app. Either way, you can either use it on your computer at home, laptop, or smartphone or tablet, whichever. They've got an app out for it also. It's called Alert ID, and you can, for it's assisting in your research and stuff, what area of the homeland that you want to settle in. It gives you crime reports that's going on. Do you know where the the rapists and sexual offenders, that's it, are located at, so you can try to locate away from them. You get to see where carjackings are at, car thefts, assaults. Also does weather reports, so you can see what the weather patterns are and stuff like that. I've just started playing around with it, but I thought I'd go and throw that in there. And right now I'm aimed towards the homeland. I'm due to deliver over in the Seattle area on Friday morning, and right now I'm trucking across North Dakota and be in the homeland later on today, or the eastern edge of it anyway, tonight, there in western Montana. It's rather cool up here in this neck of the woods. It's bouncing back and forth right around zero, up into the teens in the high area and stuff. But yeah, I know, this isn't the homeland. This is just North Dakota, so it's just a snowy right now barrier to get through to get back to the homeland and stuff. So I'll be out till Christmas time. This is December 3rd. Just got done listening to this week's podcast, so hope to see you all out here on the road, headed towards the homeland here shortly. And if the audio quality on this recording is good enough, I can be able to do a little bit more of these while I'm rolling down the road, rather than trying to go and do it in the few occasions I'm parked where I don't have any other noise around. So anyway, comrades, have a safe holiday. Hope you had a good Thanksgiving, and have a Merry Christmas. Catch you later. Bye. Greetings, comrades. This is the trucker coming at you from trucking across North Dakota in my new truck. And this is for all the t-shirt migrants. Some things to think about for the more financially challenged migrants coming out here to the Northwest. There are quite a few truckers that do go and give people lifts from like one area to another and stuff. I've got a full house, a wife and a dog, and we run team and stuff, but I have been known to go and give people that are traveling back and forth across the country rides as far as I can. There's some companies that don't allow riders, so don't be offended if the truck driver doesn't let you in their truck because company policy. One thought that you might think about is putting a tricolor somewhere on your bag or your sign saying that you're heading to the Northwest and stuff. Because for those of us truckers out there that do support the migration movement to the Northwest and stuff, that might help be an icebreaker and stuff to go and make your travels a little easier. You know, if you're not in the movement, you wouldn't know what the little three-color, tricolor symbol was. But for those of us who do recognize it, that would end up cueing us in that, hey, you're not just some other, pardon the pun, typical bum trying to hitch a ride from one area to another. Might make it a little easier for you to get a lift. And a lot of times we go and we encounter people that are trying to get from one area to another at the truck stops and stuff. They just have a sign out there like wanting to get to Southern California or Florida or the Northwest or whatever. So, you know, they go and have their little cardboard signs out there, and that, you know, that way you're not going up to trying to hit every driver that comes through. They just kind of glance at the sign and stuff and going, oh, okay, well, I'm going that way, so I can go and give them a lift. So that's something you can think about. And don't mind my GPS talking there because I'm trucking down the road here. But anyways, also, a lot of us truckers and stuff have extra showers on our cards and stuff. And I'm more than willing to go and let y'all, if you need them, have a free shower and stuff, because I know they cost like 10, 12 bucks if you go and buy one at a truck stop and whatnot. They provide towels and all that. There's soap in there, so the only thing you really would end up needing, I guess, is just clean change of clothes and your own toothbrush. But like I say, there's normally some kind of soap there in the showers there at the truck stop. So if you're traveling across, you might be able to go and, pardon the pun, mooch a shower off of a truck driver. So anyway, comrades, those of you who need that kind of advice, hope to see you in the homeland soon, and maybe you'll end up getting a shower, or if I'm running by myself, a lift at least a few miles closer to the Northwest, depending on which way I'm routed. All right, comrades, this is the trucker signing off for another little short segment from Tidbits on the Road. Have a good one, comrades.
Complicated shadows. Well, there's There's a line that you must toe, and it'll soon be time to go. But it's darker than you know, and those complicated shadows. All you gangsters and rude clowns who were shooting up the town when you should have found someone to put the blame on. Though the fury is hot and hard, I still see that cold graveyard. There's a solitary stone that's got your name on. You don't have to take it from me, but I know what I speak. You think you're like Iron Steel, but Iron Steel will bend and break in those complicated shadows. Sometimes justice you'll find is just dumb, not colorblind. And your poor shattered mind can't take it all in. All those phantoms and those shades should jump up on Judgment Day and say, Almighty, I'm still thinking I've sinned. But then Joe, who was dismissed, took his neck and gave it a twist. So you see your openness to those complicated shadows. You can say just what you like in a voice like a John Ford film. Take the law into your hands. You will soon get tired of killing all those complicated shadows. Complicated shadows. Complicated shadows. Complicated shadows.
Well, Christmas is coming, and everybody gets a little bit commercialized, I suppose, at this time of year. I don't know who did this, but one of our comrades sent it to me, and I think it's a hoot, and I suppose you could say it's definitely a suggestion for your Christmas shopping list this year.
Coming this Christmas, the Turner Diaries video game. The Turner Diaries video game. Complete with its own special game controller. Through the magic of video technology, you can be part of changing the system. Using our simulated rapid-fire submachine gun joystick, fight back when federal goons come to enforce the Cohen Act by seizing guns. Run missions through mazes of urban cesspools. Taking out the mongrels ruining society with crime, drugs, and interracial bestiality. The Turner Diaries video game. Stage 2 for advanced users lets you plan the seizure of a large West Coast Coast metropolis and send its mongrel garbage out to the desert. Then infiltrate one of the system's nuclear bases to help secure your gains and prepare to vaporize those nasty little beanie heads who've caused all those troubles. But watch out. You can get caught and tortured, sidetracking you for months. Plan your escape from captivity and head up to level 3 of the game. In level 3, you suffer a nuclear attack, but restore your honor by retaliating against those with the mark of Cain. Win the game by flying your single-engine Cessna through a gauntlet of anti-aircraft fire to your final five-sided target somewhere on the eastern seaboard. The Turner Diaries video game. Good practice for a wider, brighter society. Coming soon to a store near you.
Anyway, our time is up for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Anaban, freedom.